If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 33, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
Joe's back on twice in 1 month.
I know, twice in 1 month. I couldn't stay away. I enjoyed it that much last time I had to come back.
This must be a record. Normally you leave it like 6 weeks between episodes.
I know, usually there is, but you know, I just had to come back. Plus, you've got a very special guest on later on, which I was very interested in.
Well, we have. Now, on today's show, I think it's fair to say, I think we'd all agree this guy's definitely up there in our favourite YouTubers.
He's definitely one of my favourites.
Absolutely.
I've been following him for years.
Now we're talking about Clint Basinger from LGR, Lazy Game Reviews, which if you watch his videos, they're anything but lazy.
Yeah, no, that's quite a funny name because of the complete opposite. He goes into such great detail, and what you'll find out later on in the interview is a lot of passion and a lot of work goes into these videos. It's not something he just chucks together with a hand camera like so many YouTubers do, and they end up with 100,000 likes, the bastards. he puts so much effort into it, and it really comes through in the interview.
And I think he said he's just crossed the, was it 400,000 subscribers, Mark?
Yeah, he just hit that this week.
Well, this guy, I mean, if you enjoy our show, we implore anyone to go and have a look at him on YouTube if you don't subscribe already. But he kind of covers more, it's a lot of classic kind of DOS gaming and like weird technology and
early PC scene kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
He does touch on like a little bit of Nintendo, a little bit of Sega, but it is mainly, you know, PC kind of stuff, which isn't usually my favourite subject, but I end up, you know, 12 at night, 1 in the morning, watching his Oddware shows and being absolutely like engulfed and just interested in what he has to say. I don't know, maybe it's his voice.
Yeah, he does a mean Duke Nukem impression.
He does,
yes.
He does do a mean Duke Nukem impression.
Yeah, well, Clint is going to be on the Retro Hour in around half an hour from now. Now, if you're new to the show, maybe you've just found us through our LGR's YouTube channel. The way the show works is we come out every single Friday. We do about 20 to 30 minutes of the big retro and technology stories of the week, and then the second half we hand over to our special guest. Now, before we get to the news, though, there are a few events that we're going to be at very soon, including the annual big show that comes up in Manchester every year.
Oh, yes, it's Play Expo. And we were there last year. We'll be there again on Sunday, October the 9th.
Now, it is a full weekend thing on the Saturday and the Sunday. Unfortunately, we can only make the Sunday this year, which I think is probably for the best, bearing in mind that we did actually go out, and I think we got in about 5 o'clock in the morning before last year's.
Yeah, we weren't really there that Sunday. We were just hungover, completely wrecked last time. It
was, I probably will be anyway.
Hey, you'll have that every day, aren't you, Jim?
I would have time.
So if you are coming along to Play Expo, we're going to be there on the Sunday, and tickets are available now. We'll put all the details in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Got to give a massive thank you as well to Howard Nibbs, who got in touch with us this week and actually made a generous donation to the show.
Yeah, and it actually put our arses in gear to put a donation button on the website. So
made us realise that people are actually interested in what we do.
Yeah, well, he just tweeted us and said, you know, do you accept donations? And we were like, oh, yes, we do. So we put a button on there. I mean, look, any donations that we do get, we don't expect anything in return for doing this show. We enjoy doing this. It's just, you know, a couple of guys coming in, chatting about games, and we've got a passion for it like you have as well. But obviously doing the show, I mean, we've got server costs, SoundCloud subscriptions, you know, it is a few hundred quid a year to do the show. So any donations will be gratefully received, and obviously all go into the running of the show. So donation button is on the front page of theretrohour.com. Right then, this week's stories. And this is a game that is probably one of my all-time favourite games, I'd say. Originally playing this on the Amiga back in the early 90s. And I think it came out in America under the title, is it Soldiers of Fortune?
Yeah. I don't know why they had to have it on a stupid name like that. But it's Chaos Engine.
Yeah, now there is a new game that's kind of been inspired by the Chaos Engine. And it's going to be called Tower 57. And if you look at this, Indie Retro News has actually embedded a cool little video trailer that they've put up on YouTube this week. And it is kind of, if you imagine Chaos Engine in 2016.
Yeah. I saw some footage of this a while ago, but I think it was only screenshots. But they were saying this was for Amiga OS 4. Which is the new version of the Amiga operating system.
Well, it is a PC, Mac and Linux game, but I think they had a certain... there was like a benchmark in the Kickstarter where they said if they get over a certain point, they're going to put it on Amiga OS and Morph OS as well.
Ah, okay.
And I think it did just reach that.
I don't know. It's going to Morph OS. That's good. Yeah. It's being shared between the two.
If you played the original Chaos Engine, though, as we have... Have you played it before, Joe?
I haven't. I'm really engulfed in the video of Tower 57 now. it's one of those games that kind of pops up because obviously there's a Mega Drive and a SNES port of it being my kind of preferred consoles. So I've just never picked them up because they've always been around the £30, £40 mark, you know, unboxed. So it's never been because I don't really know much about it. I've just not picked it up. But I've only ever heard good things about it. So, and this does look quite interesting, Tower 57. So,
it's a very hard game as well. Ravi and I did a Let's Play at Christmas when we featured that. We couldn't get past the first level, could we? With all the lives.
Well, to be fair, you guys do suck.
Well, this is true.
This one looks a little bit different, though, because there's elements of Jurassic Park on the Amiga and there's elements of Chaos Engine, but it's very fast as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lots of little bits of action going on. So I think there's a mix of many games in here.
It's just cool to see like an overhead kind of 16-bit shooter coming out.
It's just nice to see a modern one. It just looks very clean and polished and just, it kind of reminds me of, what's it called? Is it Hotline Miami?
Oh, yeah.
It kind of reminds me of that a little bit, which once again was a good game. So, can't go wrong if it looks like that.
Very 80s inspired that game, wasn't it? Yeah. I like the logo on that game, which we'll talk more about logos a bit later. Actually, we have a story about that. But if you want to follow that Kickstarter, I think the game's due out in 2017. So you can check out the preview and follow that on Kickstarter at theretrohour.com. Now, got to give a shout to a buddy of ours who's actually written a book. And this is Andrew Foster, who occasionally hosts on the RGDS podcast. And he's actually a pretty successful musician as well. He does like the Isle of Wight Festival and stuff I saw on his website.
Oh, cool.
And he's actually done a book about his experiences in gaming.
Yeah, I had a little browse through this. It looks really good. It's kind of all the memories that, you know, we had as a shared experience as kids. So there's a whole section about the AMF bowling alley and how we used to go down there and play on Virtual Fighter and, you know, all the old kind of arcades.
Yeah, I've got fond memories of going to Laser Quest and not actually playing Laser Quest and just going to the arcade just to play Marvel vs. Capcom.
Well, he even talks about like, I think anyone that grew up in Britain in this kind of era will have these kind of shared memories about going into school and you find like, you know, BBC Micros and Acorn Archimedes on trolleys that would wheel around and like, why did all schools have the computers on trolleys? What was that about on TVs?
If you saw it got wheeled in and that would be the best day ever. So, but often you'd see the Acorn get wheeled in and nobody would actually get to go on it. It's like, why is it there? Is it just tantalising and teasing you in the corner?
Why would you have arcades at swimming pools as well? I never got that. Whenever you go to the swimming pool, there'd always be a weird arcade in the corner.
You know what? I never saw that, but the chip shop we used to go to when I was a kid, it had Metal Slug. How cool is that? It had Metal Slug in the chippy in Trent Bridge, and I was just like, I used to look at it, can I have a go? Nah. Oh, okay.
We used to, right, when I was at school, there was an arcade in town that was probably about a mile away. And like at lunch, we'd all walk out of school, walk to this arcade that was a mile away, play for like 5 minutes, then walk a mile back to school. We do it like every day. But it is, I think, you know, anyone that's kind of got these memories will enjoy Andrew's book and even talks about, you remember those kind of cheesy Tiger LCD games?
Oh, yeah, little handhelds.
Got like a big section on them, like the Turtles one and all that as well. So I really enjoyed reading this. And, you know, he didn't do a Kickstarter or anything like that. It is quite a small book, but there's also a PDF that you can download as well if you want to check it out. And I think, you know, anyone that loves our show will share his memories. He's even got a bit about like cover tapes and Commodore format and those kind of magazines in the early 90s as well. So if you want to find out more about his book and where you can download it from, we'll pop that in the show notes this week as well. Now, you know, recently we had that story about nuclear power stations using ancient technology, which was scary enough, but it turns out the airlines are apparently using computers that are a few decades old as well.
Yeah, well, the kind of airline, you know, the most trusted place you should be on a plane.
Got your entire life in their hands,
yeah. And they've basically had quite a mass load of outages recently, and they don't know why they're happening.
This is Delta Airlines.
Delta Airlines in America, yeah. And they had to cancel more than 650 flights. A lot of people are saying it's because of their old computer system that they've got. It's actually decades old that's running it.
they reckon that the main systems, a lot of them are 30 years old now.
The thing is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
But maybe obviously they are broke now.
What system do you think it would be then?
Well, it's probably like some old
teletext.
It's probably like some old mainframe or something, isn't it? But I've looked through this story and they're saying they don't really know why, which I'm not sure I really buy that. A lot of people are saying it's probably a power outage or something like that, or, you know, maybe more of an electronic fault than an actual, you know, software problem or hardware problem.
Change the capacitors.
It could be something like that, but it's...
Have they switched it on and off again?
I think, you know, with these systems, like Joe said then, I mean, these are really expensive machines. A lot of them just leave them running 24 hours a day. They do the job fine, everything like that. And they do often say that powering off a machine and putting it back on causes the most strain on the components. If you leave it on for like 30 years, it'll probably be all right. It's when you turn it off and on.
Do you reckon somebody just switched it off like once? Like, thought, you know what, we'll give it a break.
It's been 30 years.
It's been 30 years. And that's it, it just won't turn back on.
Bit of cleaner coming in or something. Yeah.
Tripped over one cable.
But you look at it, and 650 cancelled flights, though. That is, you're talking like hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions.
It's fascinating. I'd love to look into something like the National Grid. Of course, you can't look in the National Grid because it's a secret, but I'd love to see the older systems on there. And you can't imagine what people are using. If they're using, you know, big floppy disks and tape drives for nuclear missiles.
And this was the last time we ever heard Ravi.
It disappeared.
I did actually see a job advert last year, and that was for some government agency, and they wanted COBOL programmers.
Oh, wow.
Some of the newer system from like the mid-70s.
Oh, wow.
So, did you see the competition that they had?
What was this?
A mathematical equation, and if you could answer it, then... GCHQ, MI5 would contact you and say,
"Yes, I did. Oh, yeah, that,
you're smart enough to come and apply for us
to program in COBOL." Yeah. Now we love the Raspberry Pi on this show. We always talk about little projects and stuff and hacks that you can do in it. You know, between us, we've probably got about 10 now, I think, haven't we?
Yeah, quite a few.
There's a competitor though on the block now.
The Onion. This is what it's called. It's called the Onion Omega 2.
Why do all these computers have names that make me hungry?
God knows. I think it started...
It's nothing like buying into a full onion, eh, Dan?
That could be their tagline.
The crazy thing about the Onion is it's 4 times smaller than the Raspberry Pi. So the picture for comparison, they've got a cherry and they've got the chip next to it.
At which point, like, in technology, did smaller become better? Because you remember, like, for years, it was like, oh, look how big this and chunky it is. And then now it's just like, look how tiny and small and, you know, easy it is to lose.
You're looking at this and it is essentially about the size of your thumb.
Yeah.
And this is like a full single board computer. I mean, it's no bigger than a chip, is it?
Yeah, and it's £4.
Yeah.
£4 to produce this tiny machine. It's insane.
They are saying that the specs of it are, you know, it is less spec than the Raspberry Pi 3. A 580 megahertz processor, 64 megabytes of RAM and 16 megabytes of storage. But this is all on board as well. So, I mean, they are saying you can kind of do like headless Linux servers and that kind of thing. You can run like an FTP from it. Probably not going to be powerful enough to run like Kodi or anything like that.
But you could have it doing simple tasks, couldn't you? It would be good for little projects and homebrew stuff, I guess.
I'm sure Dan will get one.
I already looked at how to order it before. But they're saying it's ideal for... Have you heard of the Internet of Things?
No.
This is essentially like, you know, your toaster being connected to your Wi-Fi and doing updates and microwaves. They're saying it'll be useful for that kind of thing as well, where you can... You know, essentially turn, you know, you can make like a security camera out of it or, you know, anything you want to get online.
Digital radio thing.
Yeah, well, you want to do one of those. This would be smaller than the Raspberry Pi as well.
Yeah, yeah.
To make your own internet radio.
Finally get it done.
Now, there's a movie that you've been quite excited about for a while. Steven Spielberg's behind this, Ready Player One.
Yeah, and they've announced who's playing the lead role, who's Halliday, who's this, I'm not going to ruin it for you, but he's a very... integral character to the film, and it is Simon Pegg.
Okay.
Which is great, which I'm really happy about. And they've been doing some filming in Birmingham as well.
It's only about an hour away from us, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, you know the jewellery quarter in Birmingham?
No.
Well, this is. I actually got my girlfriend's, now fiance's engagement ring there. Ooh. You know, very, very stylish place. But they've actually transformed it like into like post-apocalyptic America.
Yeah, yeah. Because in the book, they've got stuff like people living in towers.
I've got to ask. Right. Yeah. What is it?
Ready Player One is a book that was written about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
They've done a sequel.
I've seen people go on about it before.
Armageddon. It's basically about a world which is everybody's into virtual reality to the point they're wearing these haptic suits and gloves. So there's, it's like total immersion.
Yeah.
And there's, it's been all corrupted by, you know, big government companies and stuff. And there's a guy, Halliday, who was the first guy who programmed it initially, who's being played by Simon Pegg.
Right.
And he's into retro games. So all of this kind of, he's hidden codes inside the virtual reality system to enable people to do stuff through playing games like Joust.
Oh, right, okay.
And all the old stuff.
Okay, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, so it's a good mix.
And Steven Spielberg's directing it, so they say that the... I mean, they've been filming all over, did some scenes in London as well, but apparently they're dressing the area now and they're going to be actually filming the scenes early September, they're saying, in Birmingham. And let's face it, you know, if you're doing a movie about, like, you know, the apocalypse has happened and you want somewhere a bit run down, then Birmingham's obvious choice.
I am joking. All our Brummie listeners.
I work in Birmingham, you know. I think this
film is going to be so big as well that it was one of the biggest books, and it's going to be so big that when Star Wars coming out, they actually delayed the timing of it because they didn't want them to clash.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah, it's going to be massive.
If it's going to compete with Star Wars, you know, it's good in my books.
Yeah.
Just having Spielberg behind it as well, you know, it's going to be.
This is the thing.
So we'll keep you posted. Movies, you have, what, 2018, I think they're saying?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it should be.
And they've already bought the rights. Spielberg's already bought the rights for the second book as well, Armageddon.
He's obviously confident.
Yeah.
Now, another blast from the past that could be coming back. You guys fans of Virtua Fighter back in the day?
Oh, yeah. Always loved the big high jumps and not being able to control your characters.
Gravity-defying game, wasn't it? Gravity didn't exist.
I never saw much of it. I just saw an arcade unit, and I was a bit blown away. And that was about it.
I remember playing it on the Sega Saturn at a cousin's house, at like a party, a family gathering. I can't remember. It was about 5 years old or something. Came out in like 93, 94. So, yeah, I would have been like 4 or 5 years old. And I remember playing it and just thinking, this is crap. And even as a child, like, you've got your rose-tinted glasses on and something like that would, like, look amazing.
Floating like you're on the moon.
Yeah.
But it's like the original version on the Saturn, they rushed it, didn't they? And it wasn't really much better than the 32X version. And then they kind of re-released it, didn't they?
Yeah.
A bit later on, and the second version was better. I mean, I did play it on the arcade, and I think for me, graphically, it was really impressive because it was kind of the first kind of polygon fighter game.
You know what it might have been? I think I might have played it a little bit later because I've got memories of playing Tekken around the same time, and Tekken came out a few years later. So maybe it was just me comparing it to that as a child.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't aged very well at all, the original game.
No.
I set like a Sega emulator up on a New Year randomly last year. I was playing it with my missus, and like she beat me every single round, but I obviously blame the game being awful.
Of course,
like, you know,
yeah.
Can't control
Did you rage quit by any chance?
I think I did, actually, yeah.
This game's stupid, let's put COD 4 on.
Look at this guy.
I guess Virtua Fighter also got its ass kicked by Soul Calibur, or Soul Blade.
Soul Blade,
came out
pretty
quickly afterwards.
I remember when Virtua Fighter was originally around. I mean, it was like, you know, Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat were around. You know, people often think it was a later game, but it was 93 when it came out. So, you know, but the reason we're mentioning this is that there could be a new Virtua Fighter game on the way. Now, the reason they're saying this is because it's a little bit of a tenuous link that Sega have just renewed the trademark for it this week.
Yeah. Well, that definitely means it. That's it. It's on its way. Is it Virtua Fighter 6, would it be?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the last game wasn't that long ago. They're making out like, you know, oh, it's long overdue a sequel. It was only 4 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was Virtua Fighter 5 Final Showdown on the 360.
Am I thinking of Dead or Alive, which came out like 9 years ago now?
Dead or Alive, yeah, it was 4 or 5, the last one, Dead or Alive?
Oh, I don't know. I just remember when the 360 came out, there was a bunch of them then, and I thought they were the last ones.
Yeah.
Maybe they were just that bad. I just didn't see anything about them.
The guy spent about 3 years perfecting the boobs on that. That was about it. Just the way they moved.
Physics. Yeah. There was actually Dead or Alive Last Round on the PS4 that came out last year. So,
oh.
Yeah, that wasn't that long ago, actually. I was thinking that I've got it on the PS4.
Oh, here you go, you've got me.
But, yeah, it's only been 4 years since the last Virtua Fighter, but I played the last one, and it's nothing like the original games.
No, is it not?
You got, like, it's a fighting game, obviously, but that's about all it has in common and some of the characters. So, you know, a lot of the Sega sites are like, oh, yeah, we need a new one, but... Then again, you look at Sega now, and obviously they're doing the that new old-school Sonic game, aren't they? Sonic Mania.
Yeah, that's
old
true.
Trademarks coming back.
Yeah, you know, maybe they're getting sensible and thinking, right, you know, we've actually got some of these big franchises that are very famous. And Nintendo make a living on that, don't they? It's like...
But, you know, in true Sega fashion, at the very last minute, they'll go, you know what? Let's just make it... Let's set it in the year 3000 or something bollocks like that. Let's make them werewolves.
And just release it in Japan.
Yeah.
Nowhere else. So we will be keeping an eye on that. You know, if we hear any more Virtua Fighter news, we'll of course let you know. We want it on an arcade, though. You know, that's the best way to play Virtua Fighter.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Isn't it? Obviously, everyone's getting in on this little mini consoles wars now as it's happening. We talked about the Sega one last week, and we've got the mini NES on the way. And
I think we should call it mini console wars.
It is essentially isn't it? Mini console wars. So the Atari Flashbacks had an update.
Yeah.
Again.
Number 7. You've got one, haven't you, Dan?
Yeah, I think mine's a 5 or a 6. Okay. I can't keep up, yeah. But I've said this story on the show. It was one of our early episodes I mentioned this. I've never really been a big Atari gamer.
No, nor have I.
You know, it was before my time, like 77 or something, the Atari came out. Even though I am ancient, it was still before my time. But my girlfriend's dad's really into it, and he said, oh, you know, get down one of these Atari things. He's into old games. He'll enjoy that. So I got one for Christmas.
Careful what you say.
Yeah. Without knowing I had one for Christmas, we were talking about Atari or something before, like on Christmas Eve. For some reason, I said to my girlfriend, I was like, you know, oh, yeah, I'm not really into Atari. They're a bit boring, those games, aren't they? A bit simplistic. Next morning, Christmas morning comes, I open it, Atari Flashback. A big smile on my face, she's like. But, I mean, we did hook it up and we have played it a few times.
I know Dan's fiancé well, and I can imagine the situation.
You can picture that face.
I can picture that face.
So, I mean, we did eventually, you know, get out on Christmas Day, and like her dad's into Atari, so we enjoy playing like, you know, Missile Command and all those old Atari games, which, you know, the good little pick up and play games. The thing about this is, though, I think they are releasing this because of all the hype that's going on at the moment.
Well, just jumping on the bandwagon.
Yeah, they're also releasing Atari Ultimate Portable Gaming System, so it's not just a Flashback. They're going to have a little, it looks like a Game Gear.
Yeah,
it looks a little bit like a Lynx.
Mm-hmm. A Lynx.
There you go.
Yes, yeah.
And what they're saying about that, though, is I think it's pretty cool. There's actually an SD card slot in it as well, so you can play homebrews and download games.
That's a little bit more interesting.
It's a bit different, isn't it, from the others?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, we're talking about the Nintendo one. It's got to that of like 30 or 40 built-in games. Yeah, and that's it. You can't even download new games onto it.
But. Yeah, I think that's really like a missed sale, if you will, there. They've missed the mark there. I mean, if they just put a little cartridge slot on there, I can't imagine it would have been very hard. It probably cost them about 2p, you know, or something like that in production, or even, like you say, a little SD card.
But maybe they're thinking they could stretch more money out of it if they only have 20 games and then release 20 different ones or have different versions.
Yeah, maybe a few years down the line. But then again, they've kind of got all the top hitters on there.
Well, I think they should have done is, though, because obviously they sell these old Nintendo games anyway on like the Wii U, the arcade on there. They just put a little Wi-Fi chip in there, make it connect to like, you know, the Nintendo store.
That's an idea, yeah.
Yeah, they sell loads on there, but you know.
With this mini Mega Drive one, Genesis one that they've just done, I was watching Pat, the NESPunk, and he was saying that they've actually had to remove some good games on it. So they've removed the whole Streets of Rage series.
Oh, really?
To put on some other games. So it's like a compromise, you know. You can only get 20 games on there, so it's like
that stingy with the storage space.
On the new Sega one,
yeah,
they've knocked off Streets of Rage.
Yeah, the whole 1, 2, and 3. Yeah,
get out.
I know.
No, I don't believe that until I see it.
Well, we actually did a little. We played a clip of the audio on that machine. It's the It's not the best emulation, to be fair. Yeah, so I'll be staying away from that one anyway. But I think it is kind of cool that, you know, these big companies are kind of looking back now at their history and seeing that people are interested in these retro systems and re-releasing them. It's all good for the retro scene, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, before we get on to our main event this week, Clint from LGR, a guest that we had on the show, it was one of our early episodes, Mr. Biffo from Digitizer on Teletext, who runs, actually, it's kind of a sequel to Digitizer, if you remember that on Teletext back in the 90s, called Digitizer 2000.
Yeah, I remember. And we had him on, didn't we?
We did, yeah. It was one of our early episodes, but he's done a really good article called Modern Game Logos Are Rubbish.
Yep.
I didn't realise this until I looked through this list.
I'm just looking through it now. And you know what it reminds me of? You know, in like after Inception came out, around that kind of time, around 2010, there was a lot of trailers, movie trailers, where literally the trailer would just show you a little bit and then it would literally just go...
I know exactly what you mean.
And like, you're literally just like, your heart's racing. You're just like, oh, best film ever. But then it's not. That's what it reminds me of. Literally, all these games, The Last of Us, Tomb Raider, Uncharted, and it literally just reminds me of just black text. That's what it is. Like, look what we've got here kind of thing.
Well, he's kind of gone through some of the, you know, amazing logos from the past, stuff like Galaxian and, you know, Streets of Rage and Rainbow Islands. A lot of these, I mean, you look back then, a lot of these had to be on kind of the, you know, the top of an arcade cabinet and illuminated and attract you in the arcades.
Well, so
they're very bright and colourful back then, weren't they?
A lot of artwork on the sides, a lot of characters and stuff.
And there is, you know, we even covered, there's like books that are released, you know, coffee table books about arcade artwork that were that good. But now, he makes a good point. It's like you said then, every one of them is the same now. And they're all in this kind of, you know, two-colour, just black
white
and white.
Black. Yeah, that's black it. And white. And it's like, oh, they've got some sort of dystopian apocalyptic dust across them. Yeah. It's like, well, I've not seen that before.
You know what I think's affected it? I think it's web design, because everybody's going to make websites that kind of look similar. And when Web 2.0 came out, there was a look which was more typeface and font-like.
Minimal.
And now Web 3.0 is like that, and it's all just incredibly boring. It's not, you know, you go on some retro sites and the colours, they're booming out of the site. You go on modern game sites and it's grey.
Yeah, what happens in neon?
Yeah.
Bring back neon.
Well, he makes a good point here as well. No Man's Sky logo. That is like, you know, it's the most boring. It's just literally a minimalistic font.
Yeah.
I think you actually spotted which font it is. It said, Geo Sans Light. Yeah. Chopped off the little lines in the A's, that's it.
That's all.
Yeah, it's more about the popularity of the font and which ones designers are sharing.
They've also cut off the tiny bit of the flick of the S, you know, just to get that little bit of coolness in there, you know.
But it's like, he also mentions like this, you know, you mentioned then the kind of, it looks like it's got a bit of a scratch or a bit of dust in it or something.
Yeah.
I love this quote from him here. He goes, oh, look, it's a tweaked version of the Impact font again, and somebody's wiped their bum across it very lightly. Everyone's a critic, right? But he even talks about logos from the past. Now, the Space Invaders logo, if you remember that, what that looked like. And that was kind of facing forward. And it does look intimidating, like it's kind of coming down on you, like the game is itself.
Like the game, it does, yeah.
But that looks more comic book to me. Like, you know, the older ones look more...
But that was the thing in the comic-y.
70s. Yeah, yeah. That was the style.
That was the style.
But I also guess it's because they're all using Photoshop to do this. They're all using the same program. Mm-hmm. And they're all probably using the same filters.
Yeah.
And just downloading the font from the same area.
No originality.
So, yeah, all these old ones would have been made on, I don't know, paper and transferred across onto some program, or, you know, it wouldn't all be really similar in industry.
Well, I think
industrial kind of production.
There were actual artists then, weren't they? Whereas now they're more graphic artists that do them,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah,
so
it's
way different.
But then
from
a graphic artist means you get trained on Photoshop to do filters.
It wasn't unheard of for, you know, comic book artists to be hired to make Nintendo box art and stuff like that. So, like Dan says, now it's just graphic artists who
What did you say about Loom the other day? It had now made with real artists.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
you know, well, this game.
Yeah, they were boasting about that. The actual game was made by real artists as well. Yeah. But I remember, like, you know, in the 8-bit days, going out and buying games on like the Commodore 16 and Plus 4. And back then, like, you'd buy games in the shop based solely on the artwork on the front. You'd have a look at the screenshots on the back, but because graphics were so simplistic in the 8-bit days...
And the screenshots lie.
The screenshots, you had, like, a Commodore 64 and the screenshots were from, like, a Neo Geo or something on the back. But, you know, I think then it was probably a lot more important that they kind of grabbed you in with the, you know, really impressive artwork on the front of the box, but... I mean, come on, game designers, sort your logos out. We're going to
move on. It's what looks nice on Steam now, isn't it?
It still needs to jump out, though. Come on. You're looking the same. So thank you so much for checking out episode number 33 of the Retro Hour. We will be back again next Friday. You can download the show from iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, SoundCloud, all your favourite podcast clients. And now, the main event. For the next 40 minutes on the Retro Hour, we're going to be talking to our first YouTuber we've had on the show.
Yeah, Lazy Game Reviews.
Now, this is a guy who, if you're into classic PC gaming, Oddware, thrifting, we love that series that he does too, The Sims. This guy is by far one of the most creative and talented guys on YouTube. So for the next half an hour, here he is, Clint from Lazy Game Reviews, and we'll catch you next Friday. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast. It is our pleasure to welcome this week's special guest, Clint from LGR. Now, we'll get the formalities out of the way first of all. Clint, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, we're all massive fans of your YouTube channel, but before we get onto that, we thought it might be quite interesting to find out a bit more about you. So, where did it all start for you then? What was your first computer experience?
Oh, man, my first computer experience at all. That would have to be in... And I was about 5 years old. It's in kindergarten, and we had a computer class at the local school, so it was actually an Apple IIe, and they had this basic sort of text program on there, and they showed you, you know, teach you how to type and how to send things to a printer and how to save things to a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk, and that just, it blew my mind, because the floppy drive was somewhere just attached to the computer, but off to the side. The printer was on the other side of the room. I had no idea how any of it worked, but it amazed me to no end. And ever since that point, I just wanted to be anywhere around computers. So my parents ended up getting me getting the whole family, but it ended up being the one I used, a Packard Bell 486 PC about a year or so later. And wasn't the same thing as the Apple II. I couldn't play the cool games that I saw in there, like Oregon Trail, but whatever. it did DOS. So I really started to learn DOS at that point, and it just went on from there.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, at that point, we're talking like MS-DOS. Was it like 5 or 6? Would it have been around that era?
I had MS-DOS 5 on mine, yeah. It came with that and Windows 3.1, so.
What kind of stuff did you mainly do on the machine then? Was it mainly gaming?
Mainly games, yeah. I mean, I, you know, 6 years old, what do you want to do? My uncle, he had access to a local bulletin board system, so he would download all the games that he could on there. And, of course, it was, you know, 1,200 baud dial-up, so they were really small games, mostly from the early 80s. So I had games like Paratrooper and this really simple puzzle game called Set the Hostages Free, and some card games and a couple of clones of arcade things and stuff, you know, a Frogger game that never worked and things like that. So it was mostly that kind of stuff. But, you know, as time went on, I ended up going to stores and finding games. I'm like, oh my goodness, you can go to stores and get these too. I don't just have to rely on my uncle's generosity. So at that point, shareware was the big thing, at least around with where I lived and everything. There were a bunch of shareware distributors. And for those that don't know, that was sort of a kind of a demo service, and it would give you a third or a big chunk of the game for free, and then if you wanted the rest of the game, you'd pay for that, but otherwise you'd get tons of really good games for nothing at all or next to nothing in the store. So Commander Keen, Duke Nukem, things like that. And it was mostly games, and of course schoolwork when I had to. if I had to do that, okay, fine, but
after the games.
And unless I could convince my parents that the educational games were worth me playing even longer. So we would go to try and find educational stuff that was also games, because I was homeschooled at the time, so they kind of treated it as schoolwork. So it was a win-win for me. I could be on the computer longer, and I was technically learning, I think.
So you were one of the rare guys that actually paid for shareware. And didn't have the cut-down version.
It's true, yeah. We did. I think the first one that I got that was a full version shareware game was Word Rescue. And again, that was under the guise of it being educational. But I mean that's about as educational as, I don't know, just it's not. It's just a platformer. So yeah, we did pay for a few of them. And then even the ones in the store that we got, you could also, since downloading them was so expensive through dial-up, it was like $3 or $4 to get even the free ones in the store. You just basically paid them to put it on a disc for you. So you'd pick something out from a catalog, and they would write it to a disc right there in the store, or they would have some pre-made for just a couple bucks. So it was really affordable, way less money than it would be to have an online service. So, yeah.
That's amazing, because being in Europe, we didn't have any kind of stores that you could go in and get full shareware copies. We'd have to send off to America and then receive discs back. So
many months later.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I've never really thought of what maybe the difference would be. And I know the PC stuff wasn't necessarily as, well, because like I didn't even know an Amiga existed until I was like in my 20s.
And they were massive here.
Right, and that's what's like just amazed me about some of the differences, because it was an American machine and yet it was more popular over there in my experience. So, I mean, I love diving into that stuff now. But yeah, back then it was all MS-DOS, Windows 3, and that was it. And it was sold mostly in stores.
Well, obviously, I mean, I know consoles were massive in America as well. Were you, were many of your friends using PCs at the time, or were a lot of kids at school on like Segas and Nintendos?
I was the weird one. Yeah, I had the computer, and my friends, they had, you know, NES, you know, a Nintendo, maybe a Super Nintendo later on. I don't even remember anyone getting one of those until like 1994 or 5. Yeah, it was my friends had the consoles, I had the computer, and a couple friends later on got computers once they were dirt cheap. I mean, you know, computers eventually just got so cheap because things were moving on so fast. So 6 months ago, that computer model was dirt cheap, and then the new one, you know, whatever. So they would get the cheap ones, and but it took a while. I was the weird one for a while, and I thought it was this weird sort of thing going on where I would try to convince myself that the computers were better than the consoles, or the consoles were like, but and truthfully though, I was always jealous because they could play like Sonic the Hedgehog and Super Mario World, and I had, you know, Shareware Paratrooper and things like stuff like that. But I was happy, I think.
I did have Duke Nukem. I'm just going to put that out there. There you go.
It's true. I did have Duke Nukem. I didn't have a sound card. I couldn't have any sound, so that was a big thing I wanted was sound, but still, you know.
That internal PC speaker, I do remember that sound.
That's all I had, yeah. And, oh, man, hearing, like, music
warm humming
on a Sega, crazy, crazy stuff.
Well, I had a friend, actually, who he had the only guy I knew at school who had a PC. He had, like, an Amstrad PC. And that ran MS-DOS, and everyone else had Amigas and Atari STs, and that was one thing that his jaw dropped when he heard, like, Amiga music.
When I first heard Amiga music, my jaw dropped. I'm like, wait, this was made in, like, what, 1985? And it had music that sounded better than anything on a PC I'd ever heard. So, yeah, that was crazy. The most I ever heard on, a friend's computer later on, he had an Adlib card in there, and that kind of sounded a bit like a Sega Genesis, so I thought that was pretty cool, but with the Amiga, with the samples and the mod music and tracker tunes and stuff, there were voices. How could a computer make voices? That was so cool.
It must have been a revolution then when you got your Sound Blaster and could hear Duke Nukem in the full vocal range.
When I learned Duke Nukem could speak, that was pretty life-changing.
I think that was for everybody, to be honest.
It's true.
So what made you decide to get into YouTube videos? What made you think one day, you know what, let's chuck this online?
That just sort of happened by chance as far as starting my channel. So, I don't know, when I was a teenager and then going into college and stuff too, that was a thing of mine, just a hobby, where I would make videos for myself, my friends. And some of them were about games and some of them were about movies. And one of the first videos I ever posted on YouTube, which was before I started my channel even, it was a video that was, you know, Spider-Man and Darth Vader arguing, and then Duke Nukem like comes in there, and it was a Duke Nukem Forever thing because Duke Nukem Forever still hadn't come out.
Yeah.
And this was in like 2005, so it really didn't know it would go on for how many more years. But so, yeah. And then some people watched that and I was like, all right, cool. So I just started posting more things. And at that point, Angry Video Game Nerd was like the only guy doing videos about old games on, yeah. It wasn't even YouTube. This was like, I don't know what it was. It was some weird service that was one of those things where you could post stuff and it wasn't very good. And but anyway, you could watch them. And that was sort of wild to me because I thought, hey, I've got all these old computer games and things like that that I don't see anybody talking about. So I'll just put up a video on one or two of them, and it worked out. I ended up putting one of them out on the Sega CD first. That happened to go up right around the same time that James Rolfe put up his. So I ended up getting some.
It seemed like you were ripping him off a bit, but
it did. I got a bunch of accusations of people ripping him off, but I didn't even know he was doing that. And then they just sort of related videos were just becoming a thing on YouTube. So I got a bunch of hits. I'm like, oh my God, 1,000 views in a week. Like, it was crazy. So I just started doing them, and it was a hobby for a long time. It wasn't until 2013 that I started doing this sort of as a profession.
Oh, really? So talking of it being a hobby, how big is your collection? Because obviously it always starts as a hobby, and then it kind of becomes an addiction.
As we all know.
Yeah, the collection is ridiculous at this point. I have a building rented out that I keep everything in now. Because,
oh, wow, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, there's around... I don't even know. If I had to guess, 4,000 something games, and they're boxed games, so these are not small. They're huge, and just 100 something computers from around the world, and just, I mean, many hundreds more of really odd hardware and software, and just, yeah, it's pretty. It takes up 3 rooms over there in that building now. So.
So where do you find most of it? Do you end up at flea markets, or is it just an eBay, or is it a lot of swapping with friends and contacts, or?
at first, it was mostly just local thrifting stores.
Yeah.
So they're incredibly just filled with stuff. I mean, a lot of other places in the country and even outside of the country don't seem to have the same selection I do. So I guess I got lucky. I don't know if it's the area that I'm in or what, but I found a ton of them there. And yeah, the rest was eBay for a while. But since I started doing YouTube, a lot of it has come in from just donations from viewers that say, hey, I want this covered, or I don't want this anymore in my house. Can you take it and give it a good home? I feel bad throwing it away. Like, you know, so there's all sorts of things like that that show up on my doorstep every single day now. I mean, there's, you know, I wake up and I'll have five or six packages waiting at the post office or something. So
did you keep your collection all along then, or was it something like you got rid of and kind of got back into again and like kind of picked up these machines?
Yeah, I got at one point my collection from as a kid, it was all literally set on fire because you know, parents were like, oh, it's taking up too much space, you got to get rid of these things you don't play anymore. So 12-13 years old, what are you going to do? So yeah, that stuff was all literally burned in a fire to get rid of. But it's maybe that traumatized me. Maybe that's why I'm collecting so much now. It's like to try to get back at like, oh, you know, I can't believe all this stuff was just gone. And then I'm trying to get some memories back. And I guess it got out of control.
Well, one thing that we love watching is your thrift store series, because we don't have any of those stores in the UK. And it's just really nice to see the kind of different items in America and all the wood grain. Did you have any influence from Flea Market Madness, or was it a total separate thing from Pat the Nez Punk?
You know, I've never actually seen that series, so it's very much a separate thing. I would say, if anything, it was inspired by Luke Morse One. He's a guy that went around to a bunch of stores in Japan, like hard-off thrift stores and things like that, and he just went around with a camera inside of these stores and finding just, you know, old things. And he stopped doing those for years, and I don't think he's done one in like 4 years now, but I kind of missed seeing those. And you know, I figured, why not? I've got so many things around me at one point that I just figured, I'll just record these. And it wasn't until I got these camera glasses to record with that, because I didn't want to go around holding a camera, that looks weird, so I'm gonna go around with creepy camera glasses instead.
I wondered how you did that actually. So it is glasses.
They're these little like $100 Chinese things with a really tiny camera in them, and they just look like glasses, and they're out of the way, so you know, I just try my best not to like get anybody's personal space and then just, you know, point it at the stuff that I'm looking at. It works out very well, I think.
One thing as well I wonder is, because over here we have like car boot sales, and we don't find very much at all there. We find stuff like, you know, maybe a PlayStation 2 copy of FIFA or something. That's all we ever find.
Yeah.
But looking at your videos, there's actually some bargains that you find in thrift stores over there. What's kind of some of the best things that you've found?
I would say probably still my favorite is finding an original IBM PC XT. It was just sitting there, and it had, you know, I mean, and for those that don't know, that is the pretty much the second PC ever made, at least as we know the term PC today. So, you know, Intel chipset, it had the original 5 1/4 inch floppy disk drive, the full height one, the really bigger one, and, you know, other stuff. It had a hard drive still in there. It's a 20 megabyte. So this is a really pretty hard to find machine in any kind of working condition. You'll pay hundreds of dollars online for a complete one, and there it was, just sitting there. And so I occasionally, it's the computers that I would mostly go for. You don't find them as much anymore, since they have a policy now where they don't actually accept computers that look older than like 7 years or something. So I think they throw them away now, but occasionally one will sort of pull through. And then, of course, anything else that is just really strange. Like, you find an open box of condoms there, and it's like, okay, well, this stands out for a different reason. You'll never know what you'll find, but any of the computers or games. And
you didn't pick the condoms up, no?
No, I don't quite trust Goodwill condoms. I don't think that is a wise investment.
God, I've seen sex toys at a car boot sale before as well. It's not good.
I've seen one or two, yeah, and I don't think that they realized that's what they were, because they were in with like the like the home decor, like candlesticks. I'm like, that's not a candlestick. That is something else.
Fantastic. So you've covered a lot of systems that were bigger in Europe, like the Sinclair and the Spectrum, the Amiga and the Atari ST. So not many US YouTubers talk about them. Were you aware of these systems back in the day, or do you find them interesting now? Just, is it something you just came across these days?
That was definitely thanks to YouTube. People like Steve Benway covering so many things like that, and I don't know. I found it endlessly fascinating, especially the Spectrum. It was so tiny, and yet in so many ways it reminded me of the really old DOS games that I used to play, and it had a similar little beeper built in and the weird rubber keys, and everything about it, it just appealed to me. So I've got three or four of those now. I mean, those are just so fun to mess with, and there's such a community around them. Like, yeah. You know, there's add-ons and people still making games for it, and the homebrew scene is alive and well. Like, it's really neat. So that kind of stuff, it appealed to me because I had never heard of it at all until it was between, you know, people like Mr. Benway on YouTube, and then Retro Gamer Magazine. They started selling that here around 2007. And it was really expensive, but I mean, I would pay for every issue, you know. And it was great because it was just, it would give you these lists of these games that I had never heard of. I didn't know what Sensible Soccer was, but I wanted to play it. So, you know, I would get an Amiga. And again, most of those were sent to me from viewers that just thought it would be really cool to see them shown on here. So I've got an Amiga from the Netherlands, an Atari ST from, I think, Switzerland, Amiga 1200 from Germany, West Germany, rather. It's the very specific one. Amstrad, a couple of Amstrad PCs now I've been meaning to cover. It's a PC, I think, 1512, black and white monochrome thing with weird Amstrad stuff, like the power supplies in the monitor and things like that. So, yeah, those things are fascinating.
Nice. You talked about magazines. When you were a kid, did you have many kind of PC magazines? Because when we were kids, the news agents were dominated by computer mags. There were tons. I don't know what it was like in the US.
You know what? I really didn't see them. If they were around, I certainly never saw them. It was mostly for the consoles. You know, all I ever remember seeing was like Nintendo Power. There was a Sega one, and I think that there was also one for it, just sort of a general all-around thing. There were PC magazines, but they were mostly about building PCs. They didn't really cover the games that I was into until much later on, like when I guess the sort of 3D revolution started. That's when I started seeing computer game magazines talking about the games that I wanted. But maybe that's just because I wasn't looking. I don't know. It was mostly because of the demo discs at that point that I wanted to get them, because it was really, you know, dial up, forget it. It would take forever to download a 40 megabyte demo or something. So it'd come with a CD and it'd have like 20 games on there.
So yeah. Did you find yourself with a PlayStation then in 1995, or did you try and stick to your guns?
You know what? The first console I ever bought was an Xbox 360.
Oh, really?
I had a couple of hand-me-down consoles at some point, like around 1999 is when I got a Sega Genesis from a friend of mine. And then around 2000, 2001, somebody handed me down their old Nintendo Entertainment System. But yeah, again, I wasn't terribly into those. I stuck to the computer stuff because it made way more sense to me, because you could upgrade it, you could get your own games for it, you could make your own games. I loved modifying games, so, you know, putting in my own sounds and textures, and the consoles just seemed so limited in comparison that it never made much sense to spend money on something like that for me when I could just have such a more versatile system. And but yeah, once the 360 came around, I mean, it got really cheap at one point, so I was just like, yeah, sure, I'll get one. And I've gotten all the main consoles since then, just mainly because I've been a reviewer and I like to try to stay well-rounded, so to speak, I guess. But yeah, I'll still stick to the PC. It's my primary gaming system for sure.
Well, you mentioned before about this, you know, very impressive collection you've got now. Are there any systems that you really want but you haven't got your hands on yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's quite a few. Some of the more uncommon things are really what I'm getting to at this point, because I think I have just about everything that you would think of as being a collectible system or computer. That, I mean, you know, I have the Commodores and the Atari things, and even I've got some Dragon machines and things like that. So all sorts of, I have a Thompson MO5 from France. It's like, you know, I'm starting to run out of stuff, and more recently I've been getting into Japanese computers. So I just got an NEC PC8801, and that is the Mark I. This is the original one that most people don't even realize exists, because it doesn't play very many games. It doesn't even have a very good graphics or sound thing at all. Like, a lot of people know of that system, or that series of systems, for the later like Konami and Bandai games, but this one is it's way older. So I got that from Japan, and I'd love to get the like a Sharp X68000.
Oh yeah.
Or one of the FM Towns computers, a Sharp X1. Pretty much any of those sort of 16-bit era computers from Japan. They look great, and the games on them are pretty legendary. So I'd love to get into more of that scene.
All of this must take a hell of a lot of research and kind of background information, especially when you're putting a YouTube video out, because there can be so many people that comment and criticize and go, oh, no, that's incorrect. How do you do your research?
Well, I've pretty much grown to accept that somebody's going to say I'm incorrect no matter what. So I try to do my best with the research for sure. And most of that does come from online resources. So I scour a lot of Google's newspaper archive. They have a news archive that is just fantastic. It's all searchable, so you can find a whole lot of original sources there. They also have a lot of magazines. And if it's not Google's magazine archive, then archive.org has a massive amount of them as well. And some publications like Computer Gaming World, they actually put theirs online. So it's mostly that kind of stuff. If I can find where people were talking about them at the time, I find that to be a far better resource than, say, looking on Wikipedia, where that's people now talking about them. I would like to try to find sources that are a little closer to the original happenings. So it's mostly newspapers, magazines, and books, if I can find them.
You make an interesting point there as well, because we've talked about this in our show before, that we often think that, maybe YouTube and that kind of thing changes people's opinions on systems and games over time, because you look at stuff now that's considered pretty crap, but then you look at the reviews that came out at the time and often they were praised. I mean, do you think these opinions do change over time because of the current media that we've got?
Absolutely. I think it's really fascinating to go and you look at the universal praise for something like The Seventh Guest, and I think that game is just not good at all. And I know a lot of people, too, that they find it infuriating to play now, or something like Myst. It's not aged terribly well. It's still very well loved, respected, and at the time it was, absolutely just groundbreaking. But yeah, there's a lot of things that I do think change, and they get much more of a bad rap as time goes on. And and that can be interesting. So I'm not necessarily trying to go against the grain, but I do like to try to find a different way of looking at a lot of these games, because I don't know. I think that it's worth respecting them for what they were intended to be when they came out, as opposed to what people think of them now. I think I was pretty unfair to games when I first started, and I would cover some things and just really trash them, and people were like, yeah, but at the time, it wasn't that bad. I'm like, all right, maybe that's kind of fair. So,
I've noticed that watching you over the years. You've got a bit softer on games.
I found a lot of your earlier
reviews. You were quite mean.
A lot of that came from actually talking to the developers, too. Because, and, they would contact me afterward. I had this one guy. He was one of the developers in Streets of SimCity. And he's like, yeah, that game was awful. It was really bad. But at the same time, I'm glad somebody's at least talking about it. I'm like, oh, that's nice. And then I had somebody else come along, and they said they were completely, the one guy was okay with it. And then this other person, they were pretty offended that I hated this game. And I'm like, but it was crap. And it was not good at all. And so I try to get this sort of a middle ground. I want to speak my piece and say if something is junk or not. But I also want to try and get across, like, if something was technically impressive or if it was done by, like, one person, then I do want to at least get that out there. There was this game, Extreme Boards and Blades, that I covered, and it's the worst. It is the worst. It is so bad. But it turns out that it was made under mandate from Activision back in the day to be something to sort of capitalize on the extreme sports craze of the 1990s, and they were given, I think, 6 weeks to make this thing, and it was an impossible task. And for what they put together, I guess it was okay, but it's still the worst game. It's still the worst.
Well, one thing you mentioned there was The Sims, and your channel, you can't help but ignore The Sims, seeing that most of your videos, the top-rated ones, are Sims videos. So do you have a love for Sims and Maxis and the kind of whole past of Sim world?
the Sim universe or whatever you'd like to... Yeah, The Sims games mean an awful lot to me because I think SimCity was the very first game that I got as a kid that wasn't a shareware game. You know, I went to the store and it was given to me, and I think for a birthday, and I was just really into skyscrapers and architecture and all these things. And so my parents got it for me thinking that it might be interesting. And that was the first time I ever realized that you could have a simulation of the real world in a computer. And it felt so real. Like I could, even though you couldn't see the Sims in SimCity, I could in my mind, I could imagine them there. It opened my whole brain to this new category of stuff that you could do on a computer, like simulating a real world, a real system of stuff. And so, yeah, ever since then, I just followed all the Maxis Sim games. I own every single one of them, and even the really obscure ones that nobody cares about. I mean, Sim Tunes and, you know, Unnatural Selection and all these things. But The Sims came out, and there was this just sort of an extension of that. It was like SimCity, but on a much smaller level. So you could control the Sims, and I sort of covered Sims 3 on a whim, and that ended up being the most popular video on my channel. And I'm like, all right, fine, people want to see this, I'm just going to cover all of them. So I have. And it tends to be pretty popular still.
Have you got any connection with Maxis then?
None at all. I have never even spoke to anyone there outside of like a couple random tweets. EA has started sending me codes to review Sims 4 packs recently, which is weird because I usually trash them. But they're like, okay, that's fine. We need the criticism. And I'm like, all right, cool. Well, I'm going to criticize the crap out of you guys because what you're doing with these latest packs is awful. But, I mean, it's my dream to, like, be able to interview Will Wright someday or something like that. I would love to just meet the guy. And he was just a genius as far as I'm concerned. But, yeah, no, just a really big fan.
Well, Tech Tales is one of our favorite series that you do. We learn, like, so much about these really obscure companies. How did that come about then, that series?
That was inspired by a lot of things that I used to watch and then were no longer a thing. G4 TV, the TV station, used to have the show called Icons that was very similar. They would, you know, talk about a game or a company or a developer or something and just give you sort of their life story in about 20 minutes. And I thought that was great. And then the show just disappeared. And then it came back as this horribly bastardized version of it. And I'm like, oh, this is just forget it. And so, I don't know. It kind of came out of doing the research for my other videos where I will talk about a game or a computer or something along those lines. And I really like diving into the history of how these things came about. So, you know, when I covered the Amiga, I talked about the story of how Dak Tramiel and all the Atari people were just this weird fighting going back and forth and really fascinating stuff. And I figured why not spin that off and sort of turn it into something more complete like the Icons show was. And I'm happy it's taken off because those are some of the most satisfying videos for me to make. I mean, even when it's something that I think nobody's going to care about, people still watch, and it's I don't know. I guess there's something there that's struck a chord. I'm happy it has.
Is it like one company or product that you wish was still around?
it would probably be 3DFX, at least the ones that I've covered. They're the ones that I think they just shot to the very top of computer graphics cards. And I mean, they made the graphics hardware for arcade systems, the best ones for computers, home computers. They were going to do the graphics chipset for the Dreamcast. I mean, they were on top of the world. And they shot themselves in the foot and the face and everywhere else so many times that they just became impossible to maintain. And they imploded in the course of about 5 years. And NVIDIA bought their rotting corpse, and that was that. They could bring them back if they wanted. I kind of would like to see an NVIDIA voodoo card. That would be super cool, but I doubt that'll happen.
So we established earlier on that YouTube, well, making these videos and YouTubing is now your full-time career. Was that scary, making that step from like leaving your job and making that decision to go into that?
You know, I thought it would be, but it turned out to be incredibly easy when I made it, because I didn't make any money on the show at all until the middle of 2012. And at that point, I had been doing it for many years. And, you know, it was at that point that I had signed up with a network, and they were able to, you know, give me a little bit of profit sharing. Because before that, YouTube said, I don't have enough original content on my channel to qualify for a partnership. So I just never had one, and I'd given up. But it was at that point that the multi-channel networks and things like Machinima and stuff were really taking off, and I didn't want to go with Machinima because they seemed like evil. So I ended up going with the Maker Studios people, and that I was like, holy crap, all of a sudden I was making money on everything that I posted. And so it, as soon as it went one penny over what I was making at my day job, I quit my day job. I didn't even give them a notice. I just left because that was the worst place to work. And I was just like, well, I'm done. I'm going to do this.
What was your day job?
My day job was designing custom picture frames.
Oh, wow.
It was a little boring. I liked the hands-on aspect of it, but I didn't like anything else. So, and most of what it was everything else. So the sales, trying to convince people to buy this overpriced junk, I just didn't like it. So I was ready to move on, that's for sure.
One other set of videos that you do is Oddware. And we love that because with Amiga and Atari, we had weird trackables and all these kind of rubbish light pens and stuff. Like, what's your most exciting piece of Oddware that you've covered for you?
It depends on what you call exciting. I mean, a lot of people would point directly to the sexy mouse, which was a mouse shaped like a woman's torso.
That was my first thought straight away. I was like, you're the sexy mouse.
It's got to be the sexy. That's pretty exciting for wrong reasons. But yeah, the one that I covered around the same time, I believe, it was the Mind Drive. It was a thing to let you control DOS computer games with your mind, supposedly, by hooking a little electrode up to your finger or any other body part that you could fit inside there. And it doesn't work at all. It was complete junk because I ended up hooking a tomato to it. And the tomato did better at the games than I did. So I just decided that was a total nonsense, but it was considered the future. The New York Times said it was like the most promising piece of tech at the time, but nope. It's always fun to cover.
So talking of big piles of junk, are you excited about VR?
You know, I am. I will say that I am excited for the future of VR, and I don't think we're there yet. I think we're getting there. I think that, you know, I have an HTC Vive and Oculus Rift and some weird Chinese ones. I got this some Chinese one the other day somebody sent me from, I guess, Hong Kong. It's hilarious. I got to cover that thing. But so there's some of these that are really, really well done. And then there's a lot of them that I think they're either going to be knockoffs or the software just is total crap. And I think that's what's making people really turned off to the idea of VR right now. There's a really bad VR. And that stuff is not going to convince anyone that this is the future. There's very few things about virtual reality that make any sense to me right now, or that would make me say, oh, this is worth spending $1,000 on. There needs to be way more software and implementation for this to make sense, because too many people still getting sick and too many people getting bored of these little 3-minute tech demos. So it's promising, but man, they got a ways to go.
Well, we actually tried one of the, I think it was the first VR system, Virtuality it was called, at a trade show last year, and it was based on an Amiga 3000. You essentially wore the Amiga on your back.
It was so heavy.
And, like, it was about 4 frames per second. But, I mean, do you remember virtual reality first time round, like, back in the 90s?
I do, actually. I remember trying some of them at arcades. They had one there. It was basically the Forte VFX 1. And it was this, it was a headset that you could play these sort of military, a couple military things in there. There was a version of Quake for it, made everyone sick. But I do remember playing that one. You could shoot just tanks and whatnot. It was like Battlezone in VR. I thought it was the coolest thing ever, but I was 8 years old, so of course I did.
Yeah, we had that one in the UK, and I remember feeling like Darth Vader, where you pulled it down over your head. Just
the whole head.
Yeah, just thinking this is amazing, and then five minutes later wanting to throw up.
It was about a 5-minute experience. So I can at least, I'm very happy with the current crop being, it doesn't make me motion sick for the most part. But yeah, I know I remember that, and I remember a friend of mine had a Virtual Boy, and well, that was just a mess. I mean, I remember that, and I'm glad that it's gone. I really am. VR needed to die in the 90s. It needed to die so it could rise again. I don't know. It's not quite a phoenix yet. This is more like a robin with an injured wing coming back to life at the moment. But it's better than it was.
I was about to say, do you think it's going to have the same crash as it did in the mid-90s and maybe crash in a couple of years' time and then maybe make a comeback in about 15 years? Because that's how I feel it will go.
It's pretty possible. At this point, I'm thinking it is, because, you know, unless the next generation of the Rift and the Vive and the other potential ones that I think NVIDIA or Razer is doing one. And
Magic Leap as well. They're doing some lasers on retinas.
Yeah, there's some promising tech, but I don't know if the public really cares enough. And we'll see maybe how the PlayStation VR was, because a lot of people have PS4s, and I don't know. I haven't tried that one yet. I don't have a whole lot of hope for console VR, because I don't want to really sit down in front of a console to play it. I think that standing up with the Vive and walking around and touching things with your hands makes more sense. It really needs a good input solution. I think that's holding a lot of things back. Like, we need some proper VR gloves like we saw in every sci-fi movie in 1995. That's what we need.
One thing I noticed as well, that you do loads of little series about DRM and kind of copy protection and stuff. I find that really interesting, because stuff like Monkey Island with the key wheel. The code wheel. What are your views on piracy and DRM and such things?
Well, I think that there's a place for it, especially in for piracy, not DRM. I don't think there's any place for DRM. I think there's a place for piracy, especially in terms of preserving old games, because nobody is doing it any other way. There's an awful lot of games that just, they don't exist anymore unless you get a pirated version. I think that's pretty important, more than some people are even realizing until recently. But yeah, DRM, anything that treats a customer like they're a criminal first and a customer later, I just don't agree with. I do find the older forms of copy protection pretty darn fascinating and kind of endearing nowadays. You know, things like the lens lock and the code wheels and papers full of endless colors and pictures that you have to match up. It was annoying back then, but now it's like, oh, look how that was pretty cute. They were trying to actually stop piracy.
Well, I remember being a kid and like everyone at school had pirated copies of like Monkey Island. And like the one kid at school that actually bought it was the one that had to sit there and do the code wheel.
Photocopy.
We were 5 minutes into the game by then.
Yeah, I would remember calling up friends. They would give me the code to Out of This World. And eventually I went over to my mom's workplace and we just copied the code wheel. We took it apart, copied all the pieces, cut them out individually piece by piece, and then just got, you know, some glue and stuck it all back together. And it didn't stop anyone. It really didn't. Yeah, it's just wasted a bunch of people's time, and now it gives people like me a reason to make a video. That's all that DRM has done, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you made a really interesting point there about, it preserving games in the future. I mean, obviously, a lot of people think we're kind of moving into an era now, well, we already have in PC gaming, where a lot of it is digital only. Do you think that's going to damage like retro collecting in 10, 20 years? Will it even be around then?
It's going to be dead in 20 years, as far as I know, right now. Because unless something changes, and there is a DRM-free sort of movement going on at the moment. You know, certain companies are doing that. CD Projekt Red is a big one with the Witcher games. None of those have DRM at all. So that's great. I think that needs to continue in the right direction. It's going to be a problem because, I mean, things like right now, it's like Denuvo was just cracked. I mean, we're talking about games that are, some of them 4 years old at this point, that are just now going to be playable offline or without any other kind of checks and stuff going on in the background. And I mean, these are big games, Rise of the Tomb Raider and things like that, that are not going to be playable unless, of course, companies continue to put them out there. And I'm sure that for the bigger games, companies are always going to re-release them, right? We're seeing a lot of that addressed with the remasters and remakes every 2 days. It seems like there's a new one. So that's a thing. I mean, that's better than nothing, I guess. But as far as original games, half the games I'll find from 2007, you just can't even play them. I'll go and the code is not there. Like finding a used copy, for instance. This is a legit copy of the game, but I still can't play it because the code has already been used. Like, that's just silly.
Well, I know on your channel you often find physical copies of games that a lot of people assume like digital only. Are you an advocate of physical games then? Do you kind of go out your way to get them when you can?
I really do. Yeah, I import them all the time. They mostly seem to come from overseas. Here in the U.S., the only thing you can get physically, you go to a store, you might find Warcraft, you might find The Sims, and maybe the latest I can't even think what are those things? They're like point-and-click Nancy Drew things. That's about it. So, yeah, physical stuff is really hard to find, increasingly so over here, especially for the PC. I haven't, other than a few companies that are doing them in very niche, low production runs, like there's a company called IndieBox that I'm a big supporter of, and they make physical versions of all sorts of independent PC games. So, I mean, they've done really cool stuff for that. They'll give you extra things too, but you know, they'll give you games like Axiom Verge in a physical copy. That's just awesome. I wish more companies at least gave the option. They're digital free copies too, or DRM free digital copies too, so that it's not like you're going to be restricted, and you get a box. I just like boxes.
I'm the same. I'm a complete sucker for packaging. Like, if it looks nice, that's it. I'm going to buy it.
That's pretty much enough reason for me. But and if it's got a backup as well, so I don't have to worry about downloading it again later.
Yeah,
that's pretty important.
So, are you a fan of any other YouTubers, or do you have anybody you could recommend?
Oh yeah, for sure. Somebody I've been watching a whole lot of recently. He's not necessarily gaming related, but as Techmoan, every one of his videos are just golden as far as I'm concerned. He puts out videos on old hi-fi tech and lots of different 70s, 80s technology that I've never heard of. He did one on like a carousel cassette deck the other day, and that's like, what? You could put like 20 cassette tapes in this carousel and it'll spin them around, and it was like a giant iPod from the early 70s. So that one's really good. My friend Pushing Up Roses, she does a lot of similar stuff that I do.
Oh,
hers
yeah.
is just, yeah, she a lot of DOS games, and she's just really good at what she does. Metal Jesus Rocks, he's another guy that I know. We've hung out before. He covers PC stuff on occasion, but he's got a really good hidden gem series of finding older games that maybe you don't necessarily think of picking up because they look like crap, but they're actually pretty good. So, yeah, those are the few that I probably watch the most.
I find myself, I really enjoy Hidden Gems, actually, by Metal Jesus Rocks. And I find myself, when I'm watching it on my phone, snapping the picture to, you know, to then look up on eBay and go, oh, I've never heard of that Mega Drive, well, that Genesis game, or I've never heard of that Nintendo game. And more often than not, they're super expensive, but no, I love that guy as well.
Yeah, they're very fun. I wish he could do, or I wish I could hook up with him to do some more PC stuff. We've talked about it, but he lives as far away as possible from me on the other side of the country, so maybe someday, but yeah, it's really good stuff.
I look at you and you get involved in the community as well. You comment on other people's videos and that kind of thing. And a lot of YouTubers think these days YouTube is not as much of a community as it used to be. But do you still think it's important to get involved?
Yeah, it's hugely important to me. I still respond to every email, every tweet that I possibly can. I will stick around for a couple of days on every video and, you know, respond to the questions and comments. And yeah, I still treat it like it's YouTube in 2007, really. I mean, that's how it is to me in my mind. I don't even feel like a channel that's large. I mean, it, you know, I just passed 400,000 subscribers and it feels like back then to me because I still talk to the same people and still communicate in the same way. It's getting harder because now there's more people vying for your attention every day, but no, I think that's pretty important, and it makes people feel like, I don't know, I care. Even if I maybe sometimes don't, I want to make it look like I do. You know, I want to at least say, hey, you know, I do want to hear what you have to say, even if it's not necessarily going to sway my opinion, you know, but I would love to just talk about certain things, and I like to put some videos forward like that are sort of talking points. So even just some of them that I've put out, like I did a video on a Toys R Us catalog, I love hearing about people's random memories that to me they mean nothing, but to them they mean everything. I love hearing that kind of passion from people when they see a toy or a game or something they've forgotten. It's just great. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I feel like I live for almost, just like feeding off other people's energy for these old games. So it makes me want to do more videos. So I think ignoring your community is a kind of a bad idea.
No, I definitely agree. I mean, did you straight away, you just struck a note with me when you mentioned the Toys R Us video. And did you ever find yourself sitting in bed circling the things you want in it, hoping your parents
every
would
time.
See? Every time.
Every time. No, I would take that and I would circle like every single thing in a magazine, even half the stuff in the girls section. I don't care. I just plop, you know, I'd pop it down like in front of where I knew my dad would be sitting to get breakfast in the morning. Like, you take the hint, please.
And then you'd never see it.
Never see it.
Well, Clint, what are your future plans for your channel then? Where would you want to be in, like, say, 5 years from now?
Hopefully still doing this. I hope YouTube sticks around because it's doing very well. I've had the best year so far in 2016. I've already had more views this year than I had for all of last year. So it's awesome. I just hope to continue doing this and, you know, hopefully I don't start sucking or something. That would be awful. But I'd like to do more involved things of what I guess I'm already doing. Things like the Tech Tales, for instance. I love doing those. I kind of wish that maybe I could make that a full-length thing at some point. So maybe almost like a history of personal computers, you know, that goes for 2 hours. That would be super cool. Maybe interview people. I don't know. That would be a really cool thing to do. But yeah, otherwise, I guess I'm just going to keep looking at really awful hardware peripherals and like building computers and stuff and see what people like to watch.
Well, Clint, I'm sure everyone who listens to our podcast has seen your channel, but for the few that may have not checked you out online yet, where can people find you?
It's youtube.com/freakind. That's PHREAKINDEE. But of course, nobody remembers that. So just type in LGR on YouTube and you will find it.
Where did Freakind come from?
That is a really kind of embarrassing story. I was like 13 years old or something, and I used to name my in-game characters off of other in-game characters. So in the Need for Speed, the original one for like the 3DO and MS-DOS, there was a character named Freak with a PH. I thought that was super, super rad, so I left it, and I just called myself Freak for the longest time. And it was sometime later that somebody had said something to me like, you know, don't be a dick, but instead don't be a dick, they said don't be a D. They said don't be a freaking D. I'm like, freaking D, that sounds pretty cool. So I merged my old like in-game name with that and kept it, and it stuck. And now YouTube doesn't let me change it, so it's there forever.
I think it's got a ring to it. I like
it. Kind of does. It at least is unique.
Well, Clint, you know, as a group of guys who love your channel, we hope you keep going for years as well, and we really appreciate you coming on the show this week.
Oh, yeah, thank you. It was awesome being here.